Hello, I'm Philip Yun, CEO of World Affairs. The anguish and outrage of recent days makes clear that we are at a moment of national reckoning. So here on World Affairs, we're starting a very, very hard conversation about white supremacy. What does it actually mean? And what role has it played in building the foundation of much of Western civilization? We're going to regularly visit this topic and others connected to race and racism. It's important, and it's among the many important global issues we need to examine. Producer Teresa Katsourilis takes the hosting mic for this episode.
In the weeks since George Floyd was killed by a white police officer, hundreds of thousands of Americans have taken to the streets. Activists and political leaders are talking about police reform that seemed unimaginable a few months ago.
We've been hearing and seeing more and more of the slogan, defund the police.
A majority of Minneapolis City Council members pledged their commitment to defund the city's police department.
In this city, we will ban chokeholds and strangleholds. In this city, we will require de-escalation.
In this city, protests against police brutality and systemic racism have also spread around the world. This could be an opportunity for real policy changes, both in the U.S. and abroad. But first, we need to understand how we got here. The United States didn't always have police officers. In colonial America, lots of communities were policed by neighborhood watch groups, or these ragtag militias, and by slave patrols. They tracked down runaways and suppressed slave revolts. Fast forward to the 1800s, police departments start developing across the country. In the North, they were notoriously corrupt. Police in cities like New York answered directly to machine politicians, targeting immigrants, black communities, and organized labor. In the South, the police enforced Jim Crow laws after the Civil War. Lynchings were often supported by local law enforcement.
We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied.
In the 1960s, Jim Crow was abolished. But then came the war on drugs, which disproportionately targeted black communities. Today, use of force by the police is the sixth most common cause of death among young black men. So when people say that policing, as a system, discriminates against black people, this is what they're talking about.
How can you talk about policing without talking about race?
Nell Irvin Painter is a leading U.S. historian and a professor emerita at Princeton University. And she argues that if we want to understand anti-black racism, we have to take a closer look at whiteness.
I am the author of Intellectual History of Constructions of American Whiteness. The title is The History of White People.
Ray Suarez called her to talk about the construct of whiteness, the police, and this political moment.
Well, welcome to World Affairs. It's great to have you with us. During these past weeks, Americans have been dragged kicking and screaming, I guess, into a conversation about race. And one of the most difficult terms being used in that conversation is white supremacy. How do you define it?
I define white supremacy as an ideology that accepts that there is a biological, permanent division of people, of humanity, into something called races. And the white ones, however defined, or one, is the one on top. I should add that over the course of time, the idea of races is a couple of centuries old. It came in with the Enlightenment, in which science replaced religion as a source of truth and fact. So over those couple of centuries, what is white has changed over time. So what putting white people on top means has changed over time. But the enduring part of that is putting white people on top.
Does the expanding frontier, the broadening reach of white people that you chronicle in your book, Who Gets to Call Themselves White, does that make white supremacy, the way you see it, a more useful thing, a more useful tool in a white American toolkit if more people are in the club?
Well, I think the short answer to that is yes. But white supremacy as an ideology doesn't always work for everybody. So it depends on what group is trying to enforce white supremacy. I think your question hints that as, say, people stigmatized as inferior white races 100 years ago, people from Ireland, people from Southern and Eastern Europe, those people were seen as white, but they were seen as inferior white races by the people who thought of themselves as the superior white races. So the inferior white races were Irish people, Italian people, Jewish people, Slavs. And the superior white people were people who called themselves Teutonic or Saxon or Anglo-Saxon, depending on which group and when. But even now, when most Americans, I think, embrace the idea of just one big white race, who's really in there? And for the white nationalist, usually they're not happy to include everybody. So they are notoriously anti-Semitic.
The conversations that Americans have around race are often fraught and difficult and knotty and emotional.
And really, really, really ignorant, because the idea of whiteness is under-theorized. We have tons of books about blackness and what it means to be black, but most people have no idea of the history of whiteness. That's why it's so hard to talk about.
Well, because it's considered a sort of default status of humanity in too many of these conversations. So when you say to somebody, take the average person, what they'll conjure up in their head is a white person. In America, anyway.
If they're a white person, I'm not sure people would conjure up a non-white white person. And especially now that we're so aware of the meaning of these terms and these distinctions.
We are having this conversation, you and I, at a time when there's an argument over white supremacy, but there's another argument that's turned up annually by social science organizations and pollsters around whether whiteness is even an advantage in American society. There are growing numbers of Americans who maintain that we're not really a racist society, and it's actually a handicap to be a white person today.
And that is that bundle of ideas is, it's not pervasive in the United States. And certainly in the last few weeks, in the last months, it has become less pervasive. That is a bundle of ideas shared by people who tend to be on the right, people who tend to be conservative, most likely Trump voters, the idea that there's some kind of oppression of white people. But if you look at the complexion and the identities of the people who run American society in terms of wealth and in terms of power, white people are not oppressed. One thing that makes it very difficult to talk to white people about race is the tangle of class and race. We in the United States find it much easier to talk about race than to talk about class. And one confusion is part of the notion that you just mentioned, that white people are oppressed. So take a white truck driver. He says, I am oppressed because I can't get a job. Then he's comparing himself to non-white people in a different class. But if he were to compare himself to non-white truck drivers, he would be making more money and probably have better, though not good, working conditions and situation. So it would help to disentangle race and class.
And yet, just that tussle over, for instance, the phrase white privilege, which just drives some people around the bend because they do exactly what you suggest. They compare themselves to a wide range of people and say, well, in relation to those people, I don't have any privilege. And just the idea that you'd suggest I do means that we can't have this conversation.
Yes, this is very true. And it's one reason why it's so hard to talk to white people about whiteness and about race in America. The idea that to speak of white privilege is somehow off the table means it's really, really hard to talk about systemic racism or systemic white supremacy. And it's much more a problem, that is to say, white supremacy is much more a problem because it's systemic. It's much more problematic than personal interaction. Whereas it, very often when you talk to white people about whiteness, they want to talk about personal interactions.
So how does this work in practice? It's talked about as a system. It's talked about as a structure. It's talked about as an unseen hand in relations between people and groups of people. If you're listening to this conversation on the radio and still skeptical, how would you look for white supremacy, the way race works as a system, to help illustrate its presence?
I would examine the particular situation of the person I'm talking to. So if I were speaking to another professor, I would talk about the professoriate, which is overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly male. If I were talking to that truck driver, I would say, well, let's look at the field of truck drivers. I would make it more exact. The problem is that for large numbers of Americans to understand how white supremacy or how race works in our society, they have to know more than they know. And they don't want to know more than they know.
Since we enter into these conversations, usually at a point of crisis, because crisis becomes the catalyst for these arguments, for these conversations, does that sort of handicap our ability to have a calm exchange of perspectives about the way life works in America? Could we somehow not have this conversation when storefronts are on fire and protesters are yelling at police and police are hitting them on the head?
I think that is going on a lot. Ever since Barack Obama became president, Americans have been trying to talk about what this means. There was a great temptation to see the Obama presidency as some kind of miracle moment in which we emerged from white supremacy and racism and so forth. Oh, we're a past post-racial society now, aren't we? And every time I would talk to, I was on book tour actually during the Obama presidency, and people would ask me that question, hopefully. And it came up so often, I would ask my audiences, you know, well, this is democracy, let's take a vote. Nobody ever voted that we were in a post-racial society. But since that time, Americans really have been trying to understand. So it's not just a conversation of crisis. This conversation has been going on probably for about, certainly since Trump, but before then, of people trying to understand. It's not just a conversation of crisis.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. A couple of weeks ago, I was talking to Merle Evers Williams, Medgar Evers' widow, and we had met on a previous occasion, and we were talking about sort of the state of race relations in the United States. And I suggested to her that we were sort of locked in a cycle where we were having the same sort of blind alley debates and conversations over and over and over again, and it didn't feel like we were getting much traction, and that I was feeling a little pessimistic because it felt like we were having the same debates over and over again. And I asked her, did you think that in 2020 we'd still be at this stage of the game? And she said, well, no. And I perked up my ears. She says, well, I always think it's going to be worse. I'm not surprised at the way things are. And that left me feeling, you know, a little dark, frankly, because I thought, well, if there's anybody with a view of the long arc of this story, it's Medgar Evers' widow in
America. When did this conversation take place?
Earlier this year.
Yeah. So like before coronavirus.
Just before.
Yeah. So that's like another era. But I must say that in conversations about race, interviewers often want me to express hope. That is kind of a trope of the conversation about race in the United States. And I resist that. I resist that because it seems to say, oh, please, please, please say we're doing the right things. And we're not always doing the right things. But what I'd like you to remember is that this is a really big country. And we are millions and millions and millions of people. We don't all agree. All Black people don't agree. We are millions ourselves spread across a very large country in different regions. And there's change over time.
I would never ask you the tropic express some hope, are you optimistic question, but I do despair that we end up sort of locked into having the same conversations over and over again, which as a reporter, I take as intelligence. I note that down in my notebook that here we are having this same argument again, because you like to think, well, we move on to, you know, the 200 course at some point.
No, we don't. We don't. We have to keep having these conversations. You and I don't have to always be in them. We get time off sometime. But consider the alternatives. What if we didn't have these conversations? Where would we be? We'd be 100 years ago. We'd be 100 years ago when the statues of leading Confederates were going up and segregation was going up. We would be back there if we didn't have these conversations. And if you look at the legislative underpinning, the legal underpinning of undoing that system, you will see that it goes in fits and starts, often, always promoted by crisis.
I'm glad you brought up statues, because not only is Williams Wickham coming down in Virginia and Robert E. Lee coming down in various places, but King Leopold is coming down in Belgium, and a white slaver is coming down in Bristol in England.
Yeah.
How does that look to you?
Well, it looks absolutely amazing. I never thought that would happen all at one time, and maybe not even in my lifetime. Of course, I never thought we'd have a Black president either. But the times we're in, you know, it's like they often say, pull out the popcorn. It's stunning. And I know that this will not go on forever. I know that there will probably be a backlash. There's one building. But I also note that as I read the newspapers about opinion polls, that American opinion in fits and starts is shifting to understanding the burden of white supremacy on people of color and African Americans. That has changed fairly quickly. And it reminds me of the fairly quick change in public opinion about gays and lesbians, from opposition to equal marriage to embracing it. So we can change fairly quickly.
How do we make this moment useful, productive, instead of just more snarling at each other?
Depends on who you are and where you are and what means you have at hand.
Well, a lot of Americans are bystanders to this moment. They're watching it on television. They're watching it in the streets. They're considering, perhaps, their own internal makeup on these questions, but not out there on the streets. In this almost theatrical presentation of an American debate, what makes it useful? What makes it something that actually accomplishes something, as opposed to just another skirmish in a very, very long set of conflicts?
It's both. It's not either or, it's both. We can never expect the great mass of people to be out in the streets, to be active, even though it probably looks like the great mass is out right now. The majority is not out, the great mass is out. There's no answer for everybody. It depends on where you are and what you can do in good faith.
Are you heartened? Or as an academic, is it just more material when you see that the demonstrations don't go on for two or three nights, but 15, 16, 17? Is that something that's not just quantitatively, but qualitatively different?
Yes, qualitatively different and quantitatively different. Qualitatively, we've seen more different kinds of Americans. A generation or two ago, you would see Black people in the streets. And now we have our multicultural, multiracial society in the streets. So it looks as though younger Americans have a different approach. I think that's very good, and that is a qualitative difference. Quantitatively, this has gone on for longer with more people. And that, to me, means things are different this time. Now, what will happen? I don't know.
One of the core demands, one of the key demands that you're hearing from various protest sites around the country involves policing. Is this a pregnant moment to have that conversation?
Since the atrocity that set all this off was around policing, a murder of a Black man by a white policeman, that's to be expected. But I would add, and here I speak of history, that the great rebellions of the 20th century were around police brutality. So police brutality has been a theme for Black Americans for a century. Yeah, for a century. So it's not a new theme that millions of non-Black Americans see that and protest that is something new. And that means that if all those people who are seeing and objecting can go to the polls and vote different representatives, not just in Congress, but on the state and local level as well, that will make a difference.
Is it useful? Is it expository to have that big debate on policing while we're also talking about race?
How can you talk about policing without talking about race? Because the visible and also the overwhelming weight of police brutality falls on Black people, but not just on Black people. let's just say a majority of those people are Black. But it also means that the question of police killing is something that isn't just Black, and maybe we can see it as a larger systemic issue. And that may pour into the role of guns in our society. But certainly, you know, military-style policing doesn't just hit Black people, although it hits Black people especially hard. This is where we need to have the conversation, coming out of the weight of the past.
Nell Irvin Painter, thanks for making time for us. Good to talk to you.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Nell Irvin Painter is a historian, artist, and author of many books, including The History of White People. She's a professor emerita at Princeton University, where she chaired the African American Studies program.
You're listening to the weekly broadcast of World Affairs. It's produced in partnership with KQED. I'm Teresa Kotsarilis. We just heard from Ray Suarez and Nell Irvin Painter, a leading historian and professor emerita at Princeton. White supremacy has a particularly long and vicious history in the United States. But this is a global problem. Ray Suarez takes it from here.
Black Lives Matter!
Justice! Justice! Justice!
From Paris to Berlin to Seoul to Sydney, protesters around the world have been taking to the streets.
The outrage over the death of George Floyd is global.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
In Germany, protesters poured into the streets of Berlin chanting Black Lives Matter and I Can't Breathe.
Australians were also calling for an end to police mistreatment of Indigenous Australians.
In Rio de Janeiro, the U.S. Black Lives Matter movement inspired demonstrations against Brazil's own epidemic of police violence, which has claimed the lives of more than 33,000 people over the past decade. In Rio alone, police killed more than 1,800 people last year. That's about 5 people per day. 75% were Black men and boys. 2 months after Breonna Taylor was killed in her own home in Kentucky, in Rio, 14-year-old João Pedro Matos Pinto was gunned down by police while he was inside playing with his cousins. People who study both countries say there are reasons for the similarities of Brazil and the United States.
Policing as we know it in our hemisphere was born out of the history of slavery and colonialism.
That's Kristen Smith. She's associate professor of anthropology and African and diaspora studies at the University of Texas. And she's author of Black Paradise, Blackness, Violence, and Performance in Brazil. I reached her at her home in Austin, where you might occasionally hear her kids in the background.
We've heard a lot recently about how the roots of policing in the United States goes back to the slave patrols and the Black codes that were instituted during slavery. But one of the things that people don't realize is that that relationship between policing and slavery was also something that was prevalent throughout our hemisphere, and particularly in a place like Brazil. And so when you have the establishment of the Brazilian police by the Portuguese colonial crown, what they did was they established a royal guard. And one of the early things that the royal guard was tasked with was policing enslaved people, policing enslaved Africans, and particularly policing Africans who had fled the plantations and fled slavery and were seeking refuge in what we call quilombos, or runaway slave communities, maroon communities. And so they would raid these communities. And so from the very earliest parts of Brazil as a colony that would become a nation, then the criminalization of Blackness has been, and the policing of Blackness have been intimately tied to what we now know to be the police forces. And what we can do is trace a genealogy from those early colonial times all the way up through now in order to see how those close and intimate ties to white supremacy have always been a fundamental and ideological part and aspect of how policing has not only been performed, but also how policing has been imagined. And so, you know, as we're talking in the United States about the history of slave patrols, their ties to policing, the ways that policing was always tied up with basically monitoring and punishing vagrancy, quote unquote, and particularly people who were enslaved, who were walking at night without any kind of identification, or who were in a place where people thought that they should not be. These slave patrols were really about making sure that those people were under control, quote unquote. You know, when we think about somebody like Harriet Tubman, and we think about the fact that Harriet Tubman was a revolutionary for the fight against slavery and the history of Black liberation, but people don't necessarily remember that what she was doing was really defying slave patrols. She was defying what we would now say would be the police. And I think that when we look at Brazil, you see very, very similar patterns. The genealogy of policing in the Americas is very much emerging from the same roots. And so if we think about this genealogy of policing as a tree, then policing in the Americas is emerging from the same roots of slavery and this question of control. And so what we have are different branches that are emerging from that, that are growing out from that, that then become the flavor of policing in our different nations. And so it's not as if policing is emerging in Brazil and the United States in conversations that are completely separate. You know, this is a whole conversation that comes out of concern around the Haitian Revolution, concern around slave revolt. What do we do if all of these enslaved Africans, that particularly in the case of Bahia, where I did my research for my book, Afro Paradise, those Africans outnumbered Creoles, and policing was the answer to that. And it was the answer to that across our hemisphere. And so they are related. And that's why they look similar. It's not as if they are parallel. It's that they are literally emerging from the same roots.
So this country, this giant country, which often doesn't get a lot of attention in the United States, has been of particular academic interest to you.
When we look at the history of race and racism in our hemisphere, we often think about the United States as the primary locale of a conundrum of race relations. But the fact of the matter is, Brazil is a country that has a much larger Black population. It is the second largest Black population outside of the country of Nigeria. It had the most enslaved Africans brought to that country during colonization for enslavement. Upwards of 5 million by many estimates, as opposed to the 625,000 that we estimate came to the United States. And so when we talk about the issue of Blackness in the Americas, and we talk about the history of race relations in the Americas, we have to talk about Brazil. And so that's how I came to that, to do that work.
When American cities began to fill up with citizens trying to protest police violence, what was the reaction in Brazil?
I think that the reaction from Brazilians who have been organizing around police violence was one of hopefulness and also one of re-energizing. I think that many people don't realize that Brazil has one of the worst, if not the worst, crises of police violence in the Americas. The Brazilian police kill on average 6 people a day in Brazil. And the vast majority of those, any estimates between 70 to 95% are people of African descent. And so there has been a longstanding grassroots effort in Brazil to fight back against police violence. And that effort has been very much connected to the efforts here in the United States. And I think that many people who have been active in that particular struggle were energized by seeing the protests that we have seen on our streets for the past couple of weeks. And I think that they continue to be energized, so much so that there was a march just the other day in São Paulo. There have been marches in Rio and Rio de Janeiro. And there have also been solidarity efforts across the country in communities that are also plagued by anti-Black police violence.
I'm always a little leery of making comparisons between countries because every place has its own history and every place has its own reasons for the things that happen and the way that people react. But even having said that, do Brazilians watch America and its racial landscape closely? Do they, when things happen in Brazil, look out of the corner of their eye for a reaction in America, for understanding, for fellow feeling, for mirrored experience? Is there a link in that way between these two giants of this hemisphere?
I think absolutely. Absolutely. So I was just watching the other day, the biggest news station in Brazil is TV Globo. It is the largest media conglomerate in Latin America. And it had a special where it brought on all of its Black journalists onto one show to talk about the crisis of race, the protests in the United States, and how they resonate with Brazil. And so I completely and utterly appreciate the ways that we must pay attention to the specificities of histories, national histories and national experiences, cultures, et cetera. Brazil is not the United States, but there are clear and identifiable resonances between what happens in Brazil and what happens in the United States. And Brazilians are absolutely paying attention to those.
Which is interesting because right now, the president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, is often referred to as the Brazilian Trump. And the two men are said to be in contact with each other, to have gotten along with each other. And the Bolsonaro time in office has been one where he has encouraged the police to get tough in the highest crime areas of Brazil. So the resemblances may be more than skin deep, no?
I remember vividly when the election happened in Brazil and when people are demonstrating, people were talking about voting in Bolsonaro and comparing him to Trump, people who are supporters of Bolsonaro. I also remember quite vividly that when there were demonstrations, conservative and right-wing demonstrations against the Dilma administration, when Dilma was president, people were calling for her impeachment and they had signs that said, impeach Dilma and Trump save us. And so there are direct political parallels between what's going on in Brazil and what's going on in the United States. There are not only actual conversations between the leaders, but also political and ideological conversations, kind of symbolic conversations between their actions. And so it's no secret for anybody who's familiar with Brazil that Jair Bolsonaro ran on a pro-police brutality platform. He is not only in favor of being tough on crime, he has encouraged the police forces to use lethal force against people. And he promised in his campaign that lethal force would be increased. And so that is the kind of climate that Brazilians are dealing with right now. And I particularly believe that Black Brazilians who have been crying out and denouncing police violence as the genocide of Black people in Brazil for at least the past 10 years, more like the past 20, or even if we go back in history, we could go back even further than that to the platform of the unified Black movement that began as an outcry against police violence against Black people in Brazil back in the 1970s. And so when we look at those parallels and we start to see the parallels between not only who is in government and who leads these countries, but also the community's response to that, then there's so many connections and there's so many different resonances. And I think that we would be remiss to not pay attention to those.
But Brazil also has a violent crime problem that is that far outstrips anything in the United States. A level of violent crime, a level of murder, control of informal and self-built settlements outside major cities by gangs that is hard to find a parallel to in the United States. Even if it's not justifiable, is it understandable or predictable that there would be this war between the police and the people?
To be perfectly honest with you, I would say to me it is not. And this is and I will say why. I understand when people turn to and point to the levels of crime and violence in Brazil. Yes, there is a lot of organized crime in Brazil. Yes, there are communities that are controlled by drug dealers and drug gangs and et cetera. But for those of us that have some awareness of the ways that these communities are controlled, many of them are also controlled by milicias or militias. And these milicias are also very much intertwined with the police in Brazil. And so there is a murk and a muck around the question of crime and violence. And it's often difficult to understand where the police end and the crime begins. And so I think that that is something that we all have to pay attention to. And I also think that it's extremely, extremely important to recognize that the kind of terrorization that the police engage in Brazil, in majority Black working class communities, particularly favelas on the outskirts of urban centers, that violence is very much targeted towards people who are not at all engaged in these kinds of criminal activities. And so I use the case of João Pedro, who was a 14-year-old boy who was shot and killed by police officers in his home. When he was sheltering in place, playing with his cousins in his house, the police raided his neighborhood and he was shot in the stomach and killed. And there are so many examples of young Black children who have been killed by police officers in Brazil, particularly Rio de Janeiro, but across the country, where we start to understand that this rhetoric of war against crime is in actuality being used to militarize and occupy communities and terrorize communities. And I think it's extremely important to not gloss that over, because the fact of the matter is many of the actions that are being taken, the violent actions that are being taken by police could be done in a different way. It's difficult to really parse out the differences between, like I said, the police and the criminal factions, especially in a place like Rio de Janeiro, especially when there's so much intertwining and so much corruption. And so when we talk about public safety and we talk about public security, we really must be very, very careful to take a step back and look at what the heavy-handed response of the state is in actuality doing to communities.
Earlier on, you mentioned that many times more people were brought as captives to Brazil than to the United States. And I think a lot of Americans might not realize that it was a fairly small Creole population in the 19th century, that is, white settlers and their descendants. So the ratio between enslaved people and free people was quite different than it was in the United States. Is that relationship with the police arguably rooted in that need to have a military or quasi-military or armed force to help keep control of a small number over a large number?
I think absolutely. And I think it's important for us to recognize the roots of roots of policing, or the connection between the roots of policing and the roots of slavery. I don't want to downplay that, because when you hear people in the United States calling for defunding the police and calling for the abolition of the police, one of the reasons why people are calling for that is because they are arguing that policing was conceived, policing was constructed on a logic of white supremacy, on a logic that is about controlling Black people and controlling Black people's movements and their ability to freely engage in society in as citizens. I mean, I think that that's the best way to put it. And one of the things that I really think is important for us to remember, that the roots of policing in Brazil are no different. And so we have this parallel genealogy that's emerging out of white supremacy that is intimately tied to policing, that influences the logic of policing until today in both of our countries. And so that is part of the reason why you see this parallel phenomena between the disproportionate impact of police violence on Black people here in the United States and the disproportionate impact of police violence on Black people in Brazil.
Having to deal with another crisis, another big crisis at the same time, the global pandemic. How has that changed the experience? You have all these people asked to stay at home, losing income when they're living very close to the margins already. How has dealing with COVID-19 and this police violence at the same time changed life in the favelas?
I can't express to you enough how unimaginable this moment is for people who are living at the margins in Brazil and also in the United States in similar situations. And I think about in Brazil, you know, I can't help but go back to the killing of João Pedro and the fact that that young boy, that 14-year-old boy, was playing in his home with his cousins while he was sheltering in place trying to protect himself from COVID-19. His family was doing what they were supposed to do. They were in their homes. They were trying to be safe. They were trying to not perpetuate the spread of this disease. And yet the police bullets found him. And so I would really hope that people could try to wrap their minds around the magnitude of having to fight death on two fronts at the same time. The Black community in Brazil is disproportionately being impacted by COVID-19 because of all the reasons that we already know: inadequate access to healthcare, patterns in inequality in terms of health inequality, and so the higher propensity towards asthma, heart attacks, strokes, diabetes, all of the things that we know about the African-American community here in the United States, we can also talk about within the community, the Black community in Brazil. And so you have a community that is precariously situated. And in addition to being precariously situated in terms of their health, is also literally having to worry about whether or not they are going to be able to survive leaving their houses or even staying in their houses while they're sheltering in place. And I think that one of the things that's been most heartbreaking to me, because as I'm a dual national family, and so we have family members that are in Brazil who are a part of the Black community, and we have had family members die since this crisis of COVID-19. And one of the most heartbreaking and gut-wrenching parts of this is that you are not allowed to bury your dead. You cannot bury your dead in the ways that you would culturally and traditionally. You cannot, most people are being cremated. And even when the cremation, you know, sometimes that cremation goes against Afro-Brazilian religious protocols. And so people can't observe their religious rituals in order to be able to bury their dead. People are having to spend 5 minutes at the cemetery with their dead before they're put in the ground because there's a concern about COVID-19. When people are dying, they're sealing the casket so you can't see your loved one again. If your loved one goes to the hospital and they're a person who's older or even a person who's younger, it's a high chance they won't come back again. It has been devastating. And so one of the things that I was really struck by, particularly not only around COVID-19, but particularly around João Pedro's killing, was that you're talking about a family that not only lost a 14-year-old boy who was doing nothing but playing in his home, but can't even bury him the way that they would like to bury him because of this pandemic. And so it is truly devastating in all senses of the word. And I think that this particular level of just despair is just something that many people can't imagine.
And I understand this has also touched your family as well.
Absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, we've lost an aunt and a close friend and another a cousin to this particular disease, and it's been really hard, and it's hard for people because they can't travel and go home and be with their loved ones right now because of the various travel restrictions. It's been hard because people are having to be cremated in order to try to protect family members from the disease. And when they're not cremated, like I said, the caskets are sealed and people can't hold funerary ceremonies in order to bury them. It's been devastating. I mean, I can't emphasize that enough. And I think that It is part of the reason why we're seeing these unprecedented protests in the United States is because throughout the African diaspora, and particularly in the Americas, the Black community is hurting on so many different levels, and our communities are experiencing similar kinds of pain and violence at the same time.
I'd like to close there because you lay out beautifully that list of challenges, the sort of litany of tragedy. And in the United States, I'm starting to see, now that we're several months into the pandemic and several weeks into the reaction to George Floyd's death, a more widespread conviction that things simply can't go back to the way they were before February. And people are starting to talk about what that might look like and how that might roll out in the United States. I'm wondering, you know, and Brazil is often talked about as if it's the United States of the global South, whether there's that kind of conviction there, whether there's this feeling that after we absorb these tragedies, we can't go back to who we were.
I think that Brazil is on the cusp of having those conversations. I think that the protests in the United States have been inspiring to many people on the ground in Brazil. People who have been fighting against police violence in Brazil are tired. They've been doing this for decades. And it often has felt as if they are screaming in the wind. And I think that the protests in the United States have the potential to energize the movement in Brazil and push people to ask some hard questions about whether or not this should be the turning point for change in Brazil as well. I don't know if that's going to happen. I think that there hasn't been the groundswell of protests in Brazil like we've had in the United States. Unfortunately, there has not been the same level of outcry for many, many reasons. And the fact that they are at the peak of their COVID-19 crisis is one of them. But I'm hopeful. I'm very hopeful. I'm hopeful that the fire that was sparked here in the United States with the tragic killing of George Floyd will be something that will spread and will also inspire change throughout our hemisphere and at least in our two countries. If we solve this issue of anti-Black violence and we solve this issue of inequality and anti-Blackness and white supremacy and the way that it affects Black communities, then we will be helping everyone. When we recognize that we're talking about a structural anti-Blackness, we're talking about structural white supremacy, it is not just about Black people. And if we are able to solve this issue with Black people, to quote the Combahee River Collective, if we get free, then everybody will get free. I think that we all are invested in this. We all have a stake in this, and all of our rights are at stake. When authorities and the president decided to tear gas those protesters outside of the White House, those weren't just Black protesters. They were protesters from all across the community, allies from all across the community. All of our rights are at risk when this issue is not solved. And so I just really, really hope that people can see that and understand that, because we are, and this is something that, you know, Lonnie Guinier said many years ago, we are the canaries in the mine. We are the canaries in the mine, which means that when we die, it is because there is a toxic issue that needs to be addressed that threatens the entire society.
That's Kristen Smith. She's from the University of Texas at Austin's Center for Women and Gender Studies. Great to have you with us. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Until the killing of Black men, Black mothers, sons, is as important as the killing of white men, white mothers, sons.
You've been listening to World Affairs. We just heard from Kristen Smith, an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Texas. She's the author of Black Paradise, Blackness, Violence, and Performance in Brazil. Earlier, we sat down with the historian Nell Irvin Painter. She broke down white supremacy for us and how this protest movement is one for the history books. This is a moment for listening to other people, and we want to hear from you. Have you suffered from systemic racism or benefited from white privilege, either in the U.S. or abroad? If you want to share your story with us, please either give us a call at 415-484-0115 or email us at communications@worldaffairs.org. To hear this program or any other episode, you can download our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. While you're there, please leave us a rating. It helps others find our program. World Affairs is a nonprofit organization. Please consider supporting the program you value by joining our community at worldaffairs.org. World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG Capital. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Tatum Sanderbeck and Julia Kwasnitsa provided research assistance. Jared Sport is our senior producer. Joanne Jennings is our executive producer. I'm Teresa Katsarilis, filling in for Philip Young. You're listening to a 1988 recording of Ella's Song. It's performed by Sweet Honey and the Rock and written by Dr. Bernice Johnson Reagan. They'll play us out. Thanks for listening.
It's when the reins are in the hands of the young who dare. Against the storm.